Welcome to The Future of Shopping, a new Vogue business podcast that investigates what the new era of shopping will look like, presented by Worldpay. Fashion retail has reached a tipping point, facing into a future in which social commerce and the algorithm's influence are growing and people's values are changing. For the next 8 weeks, our editors will be diving into what the new era of shopping will look like. We will unpack what comes next for e-commerce, social commerce and Web3, what will happen to malls and high streets, and how consumers will shop in the future. Hello and welcome to the first episode of Vogue Business's The Future of Shopping. I'm your host, Kirsty McGregor. Farfetch, Matches and Net-a-Porter were once fierce rivals, dominating the luxury e-commerce market. But the boom years of rapid top-line expansion were dogged by rising costs and an addiction to discounting, which eroded profits. In this episode, we're going to explore what exactly went wrong, what it says about the industry today, and what's next. I'm delighted to be joined by Elizabeth Vondergoltz, who has a fairly formidable CV in the world of luxury fashion retail. After 14 years at Bergdorf Goodman, she joined Net-a-Porter as Global Buying Director. She went on to become Chief Commercial Officer at Matches, and later CEO of Browns and Chief Fashion and Merchandising Officer at Farfetch. So it's safe to say she knows the ins and outs of the industry. Thank you for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Kirsty, for having me.
So it was almost exactly a year ago today that we actually met for the first time in the courtyard at Browns in London. And the retail landscape was challenging then, but I don't think many people there for drinks that evening would have foreseen what was going to happen less than a year later. By December, Farfetch had been sold in a rescue deal to save the company from bankruptcy. And of course, in March of this year, Matches was put into administration. Really, it feels like we're at a tipping point, the end of the luxury multi-brand e-commerce boom. Is that fair to say? And how did we get here?
Oh, I think, you know, there's a very long answer to this. I don't think it's the end. It may be the end of this chapter of the kind of luxury e-commerce in terms of multi-brand, but I do believe there's going to be a future to that, and what that looks like, there's going to be many different versions. But I think the consumer now does shop online for luxury. They're spending in the six digits on items on e-commerce. The consumer isn't going to go backwards. The customer, they're used to shopping online now for everything from their toothpaste, their groceries, to their luxury products. And I think we always have to put the consumer first. So I do believe there's a future to this. But of course, a lot has happened to get us to this point, as you've said. When we think about stores and retail, it was a very controlled market within luxury, right? Mm. You had certain retailers, they were very controlled in terms of your adjacencies within a store, but also who was in each store. So every brand had a very, very strict distribution strategy and model, right? And with this, there was different geographies with certain pricing strategies as well, and suggested retails, all of that. When you had the proliferation of online, I think what you had is all of a sudden it was something that was new, right? It just came out of nowhere and there were no rules. There weren't these strategies in place. No one was even ahead of it in time to think about them. So all of a sudden you have mass distribution of brands all on everyone's different websites. Brands are starting their own websites. There's no adhering to, you know, geo pricing across the board because none of these things were controlled at the time. And I think this obviously caused a lot of fear with the brands, who are now being super protective and sort of pulled back a lot. And I think it's because they just didn't have this control going into it. And if you had this sort of strategy going into this and say, I only want to work with these retailers will partner with us in the way that we want to work. I think that's the way it has to work with e-commerce as well. I think also, obviously, when some of these sites started and these e-commerce sites started, again, digital performance, search, marketing, all these things were also relatively new and relatively cost efficient as, again, e-commerce proliferated in either lower market, like, you know, low end to high end, everything, you know, luxury, Amazon, etc. All these costs skyrocketed. So again, your costs of running these businesses increased over time, the complexity of duties and taxes when you ship internationally, the increase of return rates because of shopping online, all of this affects the economics of the model. And I think it sort of got to this point, this tipping point, where somehow the model doesn't work anymore because of all these things put together, as well as a lot of these companies, you know, sort of being valued as tech companies versus looking at them as retail companies and having to either gone public or being bought by private equity. And again, you know, you have this drive or push for crazy revenue growth and therefore probably not, you know, diluting profitability, diluting some of the things that keep the business healthy.
Okay, there's a lot in there I'd like to unpack a little bit more. Yeah. I feel like I spent a good part of the beginning of my career talking about the cost of bricks and mortar retail, and, you know, online came along and there was that real feeling that it was, the whole system was unfairly weighted towards the online retailers. And, you know, it was seen as being a much lower cost model. And you've talked there about the fact that actually it's turned out to be really quite high cost to acquire a customer. And then, you know, if you're not necessarily seeing the kind of lifetime value out of that customer, then the model hasn't really worked so well for e-commerce. Can we talk about that a little bit more? Like, why is it so expensive to sell clothes online?
Yeah, listen, I think there's a part that works really well, like in all of the luxury online players, I would say 40% of the business are 1-2% of the customers. So you have some very loyal, high spending customers. But then, and you can keep growing them. I mean, there's a way to speak to them. There's a way to keep growing them that are kind of within the traditional ways of speaking to that customer. It's acquiring new customers, as you said, that costs the most. And usually, you know, in this spend, you're spending a lot on digital channels. You're spending a lot for search. You're spending a lot on promotions, right? When you open an app, you always see there's a 10% discount just to download the app, right? There are all these ways to drive customer acquisition that not only are cost you top line, but they also cost you bottom line. And a lot of the ways to enter into this group of new customers is also lower price point merchandise. So you think about the cost of receiving a sneaker, let's say sneakers, receiving sneakers into your warehouse, processing them, shooting them in the studio on model sometimes with stylists that put them in great outfits. The cost of all this to upload even, and you think about the sneaker could cost $50 or could cost $100. So there's a whole economics when you're trying to sort of grab this newer customer, this younger customer, that does affect the total business and the bottom line. It's like having to toe that balance, I think, is really important.
Interesting as well, you mentioned the younger customer, and I wonder how much sort of demographic shifts have changed the way, you know, let's talk about how customers like to shop now, because that has changed considerably. As you say, we've become very used to the convenience of shopping online. How do you think people like to shop now?
I think it's a blend, right? I think that post-COVID, almost everyone's gotten used to shopping online. Even the last, I feel like the people who are sort of the last one standing that did not embrace shopping online have had to buy something online, right? So I think we're in this phase where everyone's super comfortable with it. Some generations, it's the first way to shop. It's the natural way to shop. It's what they know. But I do believe that there's something really important about physical and physical experience. I mean, I think we really saw that. I think a lot of businesses underestimated the return to store post-COVID, especially the online retailers, because they were flying during that time. And the stores have actually done quite well, the ones that still are standing. And the brands, when you talk to the brands, their physical retail has been really strong. And they've increased that footprint and opened a lot more stores in the past few years as well. And that's actually, I think, helping balance out what a lot of businesses have lost in terms of their e-commerce revenue through their physical network. So I think this idea of, you know, true omni-channel, or this real idea of how do you have a physical space that you can also speak to your customer when they're not in town or they're traveling, or how do you touch them so that you can draw them back into your ecosystem through your website or through your app? I think that's really important. And that's, I think that's here to stay.
And it's understanding that, how to forge that emotional connection with your customers, right? I think there's been so much emphasis on convenience and logistical prowess, but if that's all you offer, then you are really competing with the Amazons of this world. You have to be the fastest. You have to be the best at the logistical side. But actually, that's not what people want, especially when it comes to luxury fashion, right? They want someone who understands, you know, what's going on in their life and why they want to shop. It's an emotional experience shopping for clothes. And it feels like there was just that little bit too much emphasis from some of these companies on the kind of e-commerce fulfillment side of things. And maybe they sort of took their eye off the ball when it came to actually, how do your customers like to shop? How do they want to be spoken to? You know, what's your customer service like? And to your point, actually, is it as black and white as saying, well, now, you know, after the pandemic, everyone's going to shop from home. So that's, you know, we have to just plow everything into that. Well, it's clearly not. We're complicated people. We like to shop in different ways. But is that comes back to that emotional connection, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Listen, I think like seamless service online is extremely important, right? So you just want it to be as frictionless as possible. But I do think what I said, when I said that, when you think about the proportion of the business that's done by a few percent of the customers, again, that customer does want to feel that loyalty. They want to feel that personal touch. And each of the businesses I've worked at have a significant personal shopping, personal stylist business, you know, and there is that one-to-one connection. And there is that need to be like, okay, I want you to reserve this for me before it's coming in, or I want to come to the fashion show with you. You know, physical events is extremely important for all online retailers because it's a way to express who you are, express what your visual language is when you do pop-ups or when you do dinners and when you do these things and invite the customer into your world. It's those things really, those high touch points really bring that, increase the loyalty of that customer.
Talk to me about kind of what made some of those businesses unique at different times. You know, if we take, for example, Matches, what made Matches so sort of special in its heyday versus maybe the likes of Farfetch, very kind of different propositions in some ways?
You know, Matches, I think what they're amazing at was really this curation, right? They have a really high net worth customer that loves fashion and they really trusted Matches. Matches was it grew out of a store in Wimbledon, as you know, by the Chapmans. And I think they had an incredible eye for who's the next biggest designer, who are the big hot ones. And they also brought in discovery, new emerging designers, and they really sort of nurtured these talents as well. And I think they built something that was really an experience for their customers that really trusted their taste, their eye. And, you know, obviously they created also within London, you can deliver within 90 minutes. So also this great service and environment for their customers. And when they opened Five Carlos Place, again, a really beautiful, high-end luxury touch point where they could come have events and they could come have meals cooked by famous chefs and also then spend time in this townhouse, you know, looking at beautiful collections and trying them on. And, you know, then you would have a stylist that would probably, you know, take your wish list online and fill the room with your wish list. And you could come in and try everything on and you could have champagne or you could, you know, it was a bit of a social, you know, it was also a social space. And again, I think this really built that sort of really high touch points onto their kind of online business and ecosystem, which I think was really special. I would say, you know, Net-a-Porter also their uniqueness was bringing this editorial standpoint and styling to online and saying, oh, I can, you know, buy my favorite, most fabulous fashion that I see in the pages of Vogue right here at my fingertips online. I think they were really kind of pioneers in this space. And then, you know, Farfetch then took that Amazon marketplace model, which was not a wholesale business. And I think that was unique in itself, saying, okay, we can join all the multi-brand boutiques in the world that don't have online. We can work with brands and really have the widest assortment in the world where a customer can really find anything they want anywhere, anytime. I think these were sort of the unique propositions of each of them at when they launched and for a long part of their lives.
And they were so disruptive in their time, right? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that people were talking about, or Natalie Massenet talked about the fact that people thought she was crazy, that people wouldn't ever want to shop for luxury fashion online, you know, and then with Farfetch, for so many of these boutiques, it just completely transformed the way that they were able to trade, and suddenly it opened up, you know, this kind of international shipping option. And it was sort of, you know, each of these businesses had such a positive impact in their own ways, but it sort of feels like something shifted, right? Each of these businesses might have had their own issues, but what are the industry-wide changes that have underlain all of this? Is it that the customer expectation has risen? Was the pandemic the kind of the big tipping point that really changed things? As you say, you know, there was a lot of investment in, you know, the e-commerce boom, and perhaps it didn't continue in the same way. That why did the conditions change, do you think?
I think the conditions changed many reasons. Obviously, the competition became much more fierce. So, you know, way more competitors on the online space, not only physical traditional department stores are all online, brands are online, these multi-brand e-commerce sites and more marketplace models. So there's a lot more competitive space than when it was really just a few big players in the market. I also think, like I said before, the rising costs of doing business online. So fulfillment costs have just I mean, they've increased significantly. At the same time, return rates increase because the more you shop online, the more used you are returning goods. So all this thing, the cost of marketing, digital marketing, brand marketing, you know, paid marketing, all of this, I mean, the costs have also, because it's so competitive in the space, also risen significantly. I think everyone needs to grow at a point, right? There's a lot of pressure to grow. Whoever you're owned by, whether you're public, whether you're private, you know, there's a pressure to grow. And a lot of these businesses started off as they weren't everything to everyone, right? Like they had a customer, that customer was in their mind and they built the business for that customer. But as you start to grow, you start to have to grow your classifications, your categories. You have to start to grow the number of brands you have because you think you need to go after more and more and more. And you're sort of diluting what your original message was, diluting your strategy to the customer that you were speaking to, because now you're trying to speak to every customer at every different price point. And I think that, again, this type of push for growth and then diluting what you really stood for in the first place has changed the proposition for the customer. And now their choices are everywhere. And how do you stand apart? How are you different? How you know, as you were different in the beginning, now they can kind of go anywhere and have an experience that they may think is equal to yours, or better or worse, but it's just, it's the proliferation of that everything online all the time.
Where does this leave the brands that are stocked by some of these retailers?
Yeah, you know, it's been challenging for the brands. I mean, and listen, they've lived through the high of being stocked by these retailers and e-tailers. I think, you know, some of these businesses are so big, when they buy, the brands used to have to like find new production because all of a sudden they were producing more than they've ever produced before. So some of them have really grown their businesses through these amazing partnerships. Of course, when times are not as strong, and the past few seasons or past few years have been tough, during COVID it was really tough, the brands are really affected because the retailers and the e-commerce platforms are going to them, decreasing the buy significantly, sometimes almost up to 50%. They're asking for increased payment terms. So they're asking to go from net 30 to net 60, sometimes to net 90 days. So it really affects their cash flow. They're asking for a lot more protection in terms of agreements and sell-through agreements and deals that, again, affect the brands a lot. So, you know, it really does affect the brands because it's unpredictable then. You know how we have to project out and everyone projects out when it's so much reliance on wholesale for the brands and these partnerships. It is an unpredictable source of, you know, revenue for them in the end. And I think a lot are trying to now pivot and grow their direct-to-consumer business more to be a higher share of their business. But this takes a new strategy, this takes investment. So it has affected the brands significantly.
And it's not an overnight shift. You can't just suddenly become a, you know, majority direct-to-consumer business. It's a very different model. I mean, I've been speaking to a few brands and also manufacturers in the last few days about the fallout from the collapse of Matches and the knock-on impact. You know, you sort of forget in a way that also there are all these manufacturers and suppliers that do small runs for some of these independent designers. And, you know, a lot of them, these bigger stockists are kind of, they're a big chunk of the business and they don't necessarily have the cash flow to support if it just sort of stops abruptly like that overnight. So it does feel like it's a bit of a broken system where some of the smaller guys really are very vulnerable to these bigger changes that are happening in the e-commerce industry. And so I wonder, where do we go from here to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again? And I don't necessarily expect you to have all the answers to that, because I think we'd probably need the government to step in for a start. But, you know, what in an ideal world, where can we get to where we have an industry where it's more supportive and people aren't as exposed? And, you know, going back to the days of suppliers and brands and retailers, that there was an element they could trust each other. You know, they could trust that even if something did go wrong, you would talk to each other and you would, you know, you would do as much as you could to pay up or pay some money or, you know, help each other out. It feels like we've lost a bit of that.
Yeah, you know, it definitely still exists. I mean, you know, believe me, I've had a million of those conversations throughout my career, and I've gone through COVID, which is really hard times. And you know, it's tough on everybody. So you are trying to help one another through these processes. Unfortunately, what's happened in the past year is the speed of the demise of some of these businesses has just it's surprised everybody. It's taken everybody by surprise. So I think it makes people nervous, thinking, oh, can that happen? Like a company I've trusted my whole life that has been so stable, like overnight something can happen. So it has put the brands on their toes a lot, and obviously them thinking about how do they protect their bottom line, and brands are saying, you know, can I, if I do business with you, can we have prepayment terms, or they're needing the credit insurance to be there to do business with you. So I think those protections need to be in place. But I do believe that if you create this, if you have a trusted players, like players that are out there that you know want to play in a full price field, you know, they stick to your markdown. Well, you can't say that, but anyways, there's suggested markdown cadences, things like that. Like the way that stores have functioned mostly in the past, and some stores still do now, is that relationship in a more controlled environment, I think, you know, is what has to happen in the future. Because I believe the consumer loves to shop multi-brand. They don't just want to go to brand sites or brand stores. They love that experience. It's proven the AOV of a customer that's buying in a multi-brand environment is much higher than a single brand. And I think we have to think about the customer first, but then we have to give the brands a trusted environment where they know they're being taken care of, their brand is important, their brand equity is lived up to, and that their strategies and their guidelines are respected as well. And I do believe that can happen if, again, like I said earlier, you know, if your site is supposed to be to a high net worth customer that loves luxury fashion, like, you don't need to be everything to everyone. So, and I don't think you need to grow so fast. Can you be profitable, be a certain size? Absolutely. But it's this sort of expectation for this continued double, triple digit growth that's sort of fueled this issue and too much inventory in the market and all of that. And I do believe we've been through many cycles before, and I always say, like, can we learn from our history? Can we learn, you know? And it's, as new generations come through, I realize that people had never lived through 2008 before either, before COVID and all of this. But I think it's about taking these lessons that we learn that have happened recently in the past and saying, how do we think about this in our industry in a healthier way? Because I think we all know we love this industry. We know the consumer loves fashion and will continue to shop. But how do we do it in a healthier way? And how do we grow, you know, have a healthier industry? And I think everyone from brands, retailers, e-commerce, everyone, you know, producers, everyone in this industry has to kind of come together on that.
There are other e-commerce and bricks and mortar and kind of omnichannel players in the market who are doing amazing work and, you know, are doing that kind of role of nurturing emerging designers and, you know, really supporting others in the industry and have that kind of very keen eye on curation. And it's not so much about, you know, growth at all costs. So I guess I don't want us to end on too much of a note of doom and gloom, because, you know, there are so many good examples of where, like, to your point, you know, that relationship of trust between retailers, brands, suppliers, manufacturers, it still exists in so many examples. Very interested to see what then comes next in terms of the disruption, I guess, because we've got here, we have the world, this amazing kind of world of online and all the possibilities in terms of the convenience and the, you know, if you can get that frictionless shopping experience, how amazing it can be. The kind of move to more experiential retail. So it's then what comes next. And I think for me, that's the bit that kind of makes me still have hope, is that you do walk around London, for example, and see so many examples of where there's really exciting fashion retail still happening. And you walk into a shop and you know, you don't even realize you've spent money in there because you're too busy enjoying the whole experience of it. And that's kind of where hopefully more of the industry will go in that direction.
No, absolutely. And as like I said, there are great examples of things that are working really well and retailers are really doing well. And if you take Maya Teresa, for example, as an online retailer, you know, they've had a very long-term strategy. They've had, you know, one CEO in place for a very long time. They have very strong relationships with a much smaller number of brands. I think their number of brands is half of what most other retailers are, or even a third. And they really stay focused on their top customer, the luxury customer, and they do a lot of events for them. And they're really, you know, they're really trying to elevate that experience for their top customer. And again, it's a long-term strategy for them. You know, stores like Bergdorf's, stores like Dover Street Market. I mean, there's some really, you know, great examples of what will continue to work and what should work in the future.
Elizabeth, it's been great chatting with you. Thank you for joining us. If you're enjoying what you're hearing on this podcast and want to gain access to the full Future of Shopping series, you might like to become a Vogue Business member. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty. delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code PODCAST20 to save 20% on the usual membership rate. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code PODCAST20. This has been Vogue Business's Future of Shopping podcast, presented by Worldpay. Thanks for listening.